this morning. Before we get too far into this, I do want to make an announcement. The co-authored book with David Reed, The Myth of Verbatim Identicality, How God Actually Preserved His Word, is now available. I have hard copies here in person at church today if you're interested in picking one of these up. They're $10 if you're online and you want to go to gracelifepress.com. You can scroll down and the book has now been added to our web store. It's right here, The Myth of Verbatim Identicality. You can add that to the cart and pick that up. Those of you that are in-house, I do have copies of these out on the back book table if you're interested in having one of those. Any feedback? Okay, thank you. All right, so those of you that are joining us on YouTube, if you click the description under the video, you can find a link to the notes for this lesson. If you're on Facebook or are on the church's website, if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, you can scroll down here under Recent Sermons, click on the link for April 21st, and you can download the notes and follow along as we go through this morning's lesson. Just a quick reminder, next Sunday we will not have this class. I am traveling this coming weekend to Chicago, where I am giving a talk next Saturday on the 26th. No, 27th is Saturday, right? The talk that I'm giving at the conference to the other pastors is a presentation of the book, The Myth of Verbatim Identicality. So I'm doing that on Saturday, so I appreciate some prayer there, but I will not have time to prepare for this hour as I have to get ready for that and then my normal responsibility with church. So be aware of the fact that next Sunday we're not going to have this class. So, that being said, let's get into Lesson 233, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, 1612 to 1617, Part 2, and we will begin with the introduction. In Lesson 232, we continued our assessment of the printed history of the King James Text by looking at the activity of the King's printer, Robert Barker, between 1612 and 1617. Please recall that we were using Professor David Norton's, should be apostrophe S, I believe there, Professor David Norton's 2005 publication, A Textual History of the King James Bible, to frame the discussion. In doing so, we considered the following editions. We looked at quarto and octavo editions in both black letter and Roman type. And we looked at the 1613 folio, which, if you recall, was a smaller folio that had more lines per page, that reduced the size and thickness of it to save money. And we talked about how that was probably a function of the fact that some of the parish churches were struggling to afford it. And so there was a money-saving option that was produced there by the King's printer, the 1613 folio edition. And again, that is a small folio, but it was still in black letter type. Okay. The current lesson will conclude our look at the King's printer. During this period, by focusing on the following printings. We're going to be looking at an additional small folio, this time in Roman type in 1616, and then a 1617 folio. And then we'll conclude by looking at some summative statements regarding the state of the King James text in 1617. So, any questions or comments before we get started with this? Alright, so we're still looking then at the King's printer at work between 1612 and 1617, and we're going to start by looking at the 1616 small folio in Roman type. The next printing chronicled by Professor Norton in Chapter 4 of A Textual History of the King James Bible is the 1616 small folio in Roman type. Now recall that there was a similar edition in 1613 small folio, but it was in black type. So this is the same size, it's the smaller edition, but it's in the Roman typeface, not in black letter. Okay. This is like the 1613 small folio that we discussed in Lesson 232, but in a different typeface, Roman instead of, and that should say black letter, not block letter. Okay. So Norton states the following regarding this edition. The 1616 folio is set from the first edition and contains only a sprinkling of second edition readings. It has some new works supplying 20 readings that became standard, together with 11 spellings of names and 4 other matters of spelling, but not enough to justify Scrivener's judgment that this, quote, appears to be the first edition, which was submitted to any considerable revision. Some of these readings do appear to be scholarly corrections involving errors that are difficult to spot. Others are simplifications of difficulties that perhaps should not be called scholarly. So footnote 15, go to the top, page 2. Footnote 15 identifies the 20 readings from the 1616 small folio that, quote, became standard, as well as spelling issues noted by Norton. Okay? Now, we're not going to look at all these verses, but I put this in here so that you could get a sampling of this. All right? So, Scribner, page 17, the readings at Leviticus 25:23, 26:40, Deuteronomy 16:5, Joshua 7:4, 1 Kings 13:11, 2 Chronicles 16:18, 32:5, Ezra 4:25, Job 39:30, Song of Solomon 5:12, Jeremiah 49:1, Ezekiel 23:23, 2 Esdras, which is an apocryphal reading, 16:52, Matthew 16:19, Luke 23:19, 1 Corinthians 4:9, 15:6, Ephesians 4:24, 6:24, 2 Timothy 4:13, and then the spelling of some names in 2 Chronicles there, and then also in the New Testament, okay? Those spelling issues, and those are particular readings that are found in the 1616 folio Roman type edition that became standard readings. Okay, so they were accepted as adequate corrections or spellings that then were reproduced and became the standard spelling and or the standard readings in those verses. All right. So in other words, when you look at your seventeen sixty-nine printing, you're going to have the fact those readings became the standard readings at those verses. So let's just look at a couple dealing with easy things like the spelling of names. So grab Romans 16. We'll just look at a couple of these, okay? Romans 16. Now, we've seen this enough to know in previous lessons that spelling of names was sort of not standardized and is widely varied, all right? But this is obviously not a major problem. Look at Romans 16, verse 10. Romans 16, verse 10. So we have a couple different names here. Salute Apelles, approved in Christ. Salute them which are of Archibulus. Is that how you would say that? Aristobulus. Aristobulus?
Yeah.
Okay. Household. So you got two different names in there. Norton is not specific as to which names are getting standardized in spelling, but we've seen enough of this now to know kind of what we're dealing with. We could probably compare this to a 1611 here, so let's just do that quick. So I'll call up the 1611 website, and we want Romans 16, and what verse is that?
10.
All right, so, come on. Why will that not zoom in? That's frustrating. So let's look at the first name there. Apelles, that seems to be pretty, the 1611 has it spelled A-P-P-E-L-L-E-S. I believe that's the same, right? The first P, one of these P's?
No, single P.
Single P?
In the current one.
In the current one. So, double P in the 1611, single P. And then the other name,
Aristobulus,
A-R-I-S-T-O-B. U, that's the same, right? So it's the first name that has spelling change, dropping a double P to a single P, okay? So that happens in the 16, that spelling change of the name happens in the 1616 Roman type folio, and then does that become the standard reading? This is the point that Norton is making. Let's look at one more. Just go to Revelation 7. Go to Revelation 7. And verse 5. So again, you guys can sit here if you're so inclined with that list, which I know you're all going to run home and do. That's the first thing you're going to do when you get home, right? You're not even going to eat lunch or take a nap. You're going to first look at the spelling of these names, right? I figured as much. Revelation 7, 5 says, of the tribe of Simeon were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Levi were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Issachar were sealed 12,000. That was Revelation 7, 5, right? No, I was reading verse 7. Sorry. Of the tribe of Judah were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Reuben were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Gad were sealed 12,000. So let's just check this out. Let's go to Revelation 7. And we want verse 5. I don't know if the internet is slow or what the deal is here, but here's verse 5. Of the tribe of Judah, spelled J-U-D-A, that's the same, right?
Yeah.
The tribe of Reuben, R-U-B-E-N, that's the same, right?
R-E-U.
So there's an E
added
here in yours, right? That was not in the 1611.
My Judah has an H.
And
your Judah has an H.
So your Judah, how is your Judah spelled?
J-U-D-A-H.
Really?
Yeah, mine's special.
What about, and Gad's the same though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Gad. So, really, yours has an H at the end.
Yeah.
Mine doesn't.
Mine doesn't.
Man, you must not have the Word of God, Sylvia. that's a joke, okay? Internet, that was a joke. Calm down, everybody. Someone added an H. Uh-oh. But that's an interesting add because... there's no H in the 1611, so... that's the kind of stuff, though, that we're talking about. Like, for some people, that would be, like, a major problem, right? Because they're that concerned with verbatim identicality, right? So that is an interesting thing. Who did publish that one?
World Publishers in Iowa.
World Bible Publishers,
yeah.
Iowa Falls.
So my Schofield doesn't have the H, which is published by Oxford Press, and no one else has an H there either, huh?
I'll go buy a new Bible.
No, I'm just messing with you. I was teasing you. But this is the kind of stuff, right? So you've got these, so Reuben, so the big change is in the 1611 behind me, Reuben did not have an E, right? It just said R-U-B-E-N. There was no E in Reuben, right? Does yours have the E in Reuben?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay. Anyway, so get back to the notes. We could look. So I know we only looked there at a couple of those. Let's just look at one more. Go to Acts 1:1. I'm not even sure which one this is. I'll be honest with you. I would say 95% of these examples I look up. But after a while, I've looked at so many of them, I can't remember what the exact issue is in every single one of these. So there's a spelling change somewhere in Acts 1:1. We should be able to spot it. It's probably the name.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you look at your Bible, has Theophilus, right? So there's... so here's the 1611. Spells it T H E O. Is that the same so far?
Yeah.
P H I L U S.
Yeah.
Same.
So that's the same. So where's the spelling? Maybe treatise? T-R-E-A-T-I-S-E?
Yep, same.
So where's the spelling difference? Jesus is spelled the same? I'm not sure, because if you look at the notes, he's got a note there of a spelling change at... Oh, no wonder. No, is it due? I read it wrong. It's Amos 1:1. Go to Acts 4:17. It would help if the teacher could read. There is one there. There is one in Acts 1:1. There's an E at the end of doe or do. That's not there. But that doesn't mean, though, that became the standard reading in the 1616, all right? Acts 4, verse 17. Be interesting to see on this one. Yeah, this one doesn't necessarily have to have a name. Verse 17, right? Is that what's on the list? Verse 17, but that it spread no further. Oh, there it is. Farther.
Further.
See? F-A-R-T-H-E-R. Farther versus what?
Further.
Further. Okay, with a U. There's a spelling difference, okay? Among the people, let us straightly, I think, is the same.
Yep.
S-T, that's the same. Threaten is the same. Them, that they speak henceforth to no man in this name. I think that's...
Speak has an E there.
Speak has an E at the end, which was common. Whoops, I'm in the wrong verse. Speak has an E at the end, which was common. I think the main spelling difference is probably farther versus further. Okay? So you can see the kinds of things that are going on. So let's go back to the notes. So we could spend all hour just looking up every single one of those, which we're not going to do. We've seen enough already. So according to Norton, let's go to the next bullet point. According to Norton, there appear to be some corrections in this edition which stem from scholarly knowledge of the original languages. Okay? So this would be a different kind of a thing, where a change seems to be made on the basis of an awareness of a Hebrew or Greek something going on. Okay? Some knowledge, either of the originals or of older translations, is brought to bear at Leviticus 26:40. The first edition has an omission. If they shall confess the iniquity of their fathers, should be, if they shall confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers. Now, the omission is not obvious, so its correction probably reflects genuine knowledge. Either information was supplied to the printer of this folio, or there was scholarly work in-house. Reference to the translator's manuscript seems unlikely, since Bot 1602 has iniquities of their fathers. This correction could have been made from knowledge of the older English versions, as could correction of a similar hidden omission in 2 Timothy 4:13, where the printer of the first edition seems to have been misled by the first part of the verse. The cloak that I left at Troas with Carpus, when thou comest, bring with thee, but especially the parchments. 1616 restores the earlier versions and the books after bring thee. So let's look at that quick. Go to 2 Timothy 4:13. 2 Timothy 4:13. And I will look it up here. 4:13, 2 Timothy 4. All right, so it's going to span two pages, okay? The cloak that I left at Troas with Carpus, when thou comest, bring with thee, but especially the parchments, right? So yours says, the cloak that I left at Troas with Carpus, when thou comest, bring with thee, and the books, but especially the parchments. So what is the main difference here? What's that?
And the books.
And the books at the end, right? Or no, and the books in this clause right here. Before, but especially the parchments. So there's a clause that's missing here in the 1611 that is in the 1769. According to what Norton is saying here, it is this 1616 folio that caught that mistake and put it in. Here is his point though, right? If you're just looking at a 1611, is it obvious to you that there's an error there if you don't know the original languages or aren't comparing it to previous editions? It's not apparent to you unless there is somebody in the print shop who's aware of some more scholarly type issues with that verse, right? Now, I don't have time to do it, but I could find the 1602 Bishop's Bible that I have a copy of, and we could pull it up. And if you compared this, if you compared the 1611 here to a 1602 Bishop's, I'm sure it would be pretty clear that something is possibly awry. Now, I say I'm not going to do things, and then I end up doing things I say I'm not going to do. But I also feel that sometimes these things are necessary for people to see what's going on. So here's my copy of a 1602 Bishop's. Hopefully this will load quick enough, and we can look at the point that Norton is trying to make. This is one of the issues I have with people sometimes when they read Norton. They don't necessarily have access to all the materials, so when he says stuff, I don't know if they don't believe him or if they just don't have the capacity to check what's going on. Now, of course, that's taking longer than I want it to, so maybe we'll come back to this and move on if we have time. Okay, so let's go back to the notes. Just somebody remind me if we have time to look at this, assuming the Bible will load. Okay, so the 1616. So I'm in the same. I'm in this paragraph right here. Okay, right here. 1616. 1616 restores the earlier versions and the books after bring with thee. Some of the other readings clearly show recourse to them where the first edition appears difficult, as in the correction of prepared to repaired at 2 Chronicles 32:5, or the substitution of the older appointed to death for approved to death in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 verse 9. Some of the readings found in the 1616 folio were picked up by later editions and became the standard reading according to Norton. So the 1616 folio had a mixture of simplification and scholarship, which on balance seems to come from the older translations. The revisions may result from notes supplied to the printer, and it is worth noting that many of them were not immediately picked up by other editions. Its readings were consulted by the makers of the Cambridge 1629 edition and may become current from that edition. Now, yes, somebody have a question? Why is this taking so long to load? You're putting a... Let's come back to that if we can. So the point here is, is it taking a while for all these things to get smoothed out? Yes. As you look at these different printings, right? So let's go to page 3, and maybe we'll be able to check this, if, of course. All right, so what we need, what was it, 2 Timothy? The example we were looking at is 2 Timothy 4, right? So I just have to find that. Okay, we're in 1 Corinthians. No, I probably went too far. Yep. All right, we got Colossians. And what's the verse I need?
2 Timothy 4:13.
All right. So here we are. This is a 1602 bishops, right? So we're looking at this verse right here, right? So the 1611, remember, left out the clause and the books, right? You can see it right here. The cloak which I left at Troas with Carpus, when thou comest, bring with thee. It should say right here, and the books, right? But especially the parchments, and it doesn't say and the books. If you go to a 1602 bishops, notice what it says. And the cloak that I left at Troas with Carpus, when thou comest, bring with thee, and the books, right? But especially the parchments. So the decision to reintroduce the phrase and the books, it could have come either from someone looking at Greek, that is one option, and realized that they forgot something. Or it could have come from somebody looking at prior English editions and realizing there was a phrase that had been what?
Left out.
Somebody could have pointed the missing phrase out and they could have written it down as something that needed to be fixed. There's any number of explanations for how that this gets fixed in the 1616. But the point is this. Once it is fixed in 1616, does it become then the standard reading in all subsequent editions to include that phrase? Okay. Now, does everybody see, this is why I decided I was going to go here, because when you look, can you see that something was clearly left out?
Mm-hmm.
All right. You don't necessarily need to know Greek to be able to see that. All you have to be able to do is compare English with English to realize that when the 1611 left that phrase out, is that a problem? But here's the point. If you're just reading the 1611, is it apparent that there's a problem there? It's not. You have to either know Greek or you have to be aware of prior English what? Readings, because if all you're doing is looking at the 1611, there's nothing right there that says a phrase is missing unless you're aware of what it is supposed, how it is supposed to read. Does that make sense? Okay. Let's go now to page 3. In the notes. 1617, folio. Professor Norton begins his discussion of this third large folio edition by noting some of its idiosyncratic readings. This is quoting from pages 79 and 80. This, the third large folio edition, supplies 6 surviving readings and an amusing misprint in the header, Bell and the Dragon. The printer's blunder is corrected at Psalms 69:32, seek good becomes seek God, and what may also be a printer's error, the seal in 2 Timothy chapter 2 verse 19 is changed to the reading of the previous translations, this seal. 3 of the corrections involve readings which the first edition is perhaps difficult, but certainly the corrections in Bob 1602 show deliberate. The translators struck through the bishop's Bible ye at Malachi chapter 4 verse 2, producing and shall go forth. 1617 smooths the English back to and ye shall go forth. Similarly, making things easier, it changes of this side of Jordan to on this side Jordan, Deuteronomy 4, did I read that wrong? Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 49. Though the translators had deliberately used of, perhaps because of the absence of a preposition in the Hebrew, thirdly, it slips an article into the bishop's Bible text where the translators chose to retain and villages, giving and the villages at Joshua 16:13. The last of the 6 readings is flee for fly in Proverbs chapter 28 verse 17, a spelling variation. So I would read that flee. They probably would have read that fly, possibly. Okay. But the point is there a spelling change? Okay. Collation of the first and second folio editions reveals that the text of the 16:7 folio was a mixture of the two. Though, the 16:17 folio has minimal original editorial work, it may be important in a different way. It shows that after 6 years, the text had reached a thoroughly mixed state where variations between the first and second editions are concerned. But this mixing is probably not random. Rather, it suggests a degree of collation between the first and second editions that produced quite a few deliberately chosen readings. If the choices were made by a representative of the translators, or better still, with reference to the original manuscript, they would have a real authority. However, there is no way of showing that either of these possibilities happened. So, this is, again, the hard thing for a lot of people to deal with. Okay, let's read that again. If the choices were made by... So, let me back up. Is there some editorial stuff going on here as this is working its way through? Okay, so if the choices, that referring to these slight editorial changes, if the choices were made by a representative of the translators, so that would mean there was a translator in the room over their shoulder while they're actually working on the text, okay? Or better still, with reference to the original manuscript, that would not be referring to Greek or Hebrew. That would be referring to whatever the translators gave the printer. In this context, that's what he means by original, okay? They would have real authority. So in other words, if the editors and the printers of the text are editing and changing based upon a translator assisting or reference to whatever the translators gave the printer, then whatever these edits are they authoritative to what the translators wanted? Okay? But here's the catch, right? However, there is no way of showing that either of these possibilities happened. We don't know. The simple thing is we don't know whether there was a translator in the room or not. We don't know if all of these were made by reference to whatever the translators handed the printer. So this is sort of the fact that people that I get in trouble for, because I say things like, I'm not convinced that every single one of these things is automatically reflective of the work of what the translators wanted. It is theoretically possible that some of these, and what we're talking about is admittedly minor edits, okay? But some of these edits could theoretically, just as logically, not have been what they wanted in every case or what they intended in every case. Is everybody following that? Appendix 5 gives a selective collation of this edition's readings with the first and second editions. It is constructed on the same principles as Appendix 4, with the addition of instances where the 16:17 folio follows readings found in some but not all copies of the second edition. A general scan of the list shows a much more even mix of first and second readings than was found in the 16:13 folio. Nowhere is there a consistent stretch of readings from one or other of the first two editions as there was in the 16:13. So go to page 4. I gave you all of this for your edification, should you want to look at it, which I know you'll all check diligently. Uh-huh. The following are images of Norton's fifth appendix titled Selective Collation of the 16:17 Folio with the First and Second Editions. And again, things that are left justified are indicative of the first edition. Things that are right justified are indicative of changes coming from the second edition. And you can go through all of that and see for yourself kind of, you know, what's going on, all right? Any questions so far? This guys, I think, is why a lot of people don't talk about this. Because this gets very tedious, okay? This gets very tedious and it gets very time-consuming. So I'm trying to strike a balance between giving you enough to understand what happened and giving you more than you need so you can check stuff out if you want to, because you can all jump on this website. It's totally free. Pull up the 1611 and look at it yourself. You don't need me to do it. And then you could go through and look at, okay, what are some of these changes and how are they working their way through? Okay. So the appendix starts on page 4 and it runs all of page 5, all of page 6, all of page 7, which would then put us on page 8. Okay. But I gave you the entire appendix so that you could check that stuff out if you want to look at it. All right. All right. Any questions before we move on? Now, it seems to me, I'll just say this, I don't know how, let me put it this way, there's a certain level of speculation on Norton's part and on the part of others, because the reality is we simply don't know what the translators gave the printer. We don't know. We don't know what form it was in. Was it a complete Bishop's Bible edited? Was it a handwritten copy of the entire Bible? I doubt it. Okay, we just don't know. And if there was such a document, it is certainly not known to have survived history. So in the absence of said document, and in the absence of any more details, we have to go off of what we do have to make the best educated guesses and understandings about what was happening here. So what do we have? We have manuscript 98, we have Bod 1602, we have the 1611, and we have all the subsequent editions that came from it. We have the 1602 bishops, and so you have to just look at things, and there's certainly going to be a certain level of speculation. So here is my point. Some people could listen to what I'm saying and they could say, well, you're speculating. Okay, yeah, I admit it. There's a certain level of speculation. But that doesn't go away by somebody who thinks differently than I do. They're speculating about certain things as well. And to me, that's unavoidable when you have a conversation about this. All right? So, if there's no comments or questions, we'll go to page 8. Top of the page. In the next couple of paragraphs, Norton presents his case that the second edition served as the base text for the 1617 folio. He says, quote, "The reproduction of errors, including some that are blatant, shows that the basic text was the second edition. Among these are fallow deer for fallow deer in 1 Kings 4, verse 23, golden went for gold went, 2 Chronicles 9:15, and this is I think a marginal note here. The HEB Heb for Hab at Psalm 27:14. Their spears, spelled T-H-E-R-E, for their spears, T-H-E-I-R, a mistake that every high school student makes routinely. Okay, Isaiah chapter 2 verse 4. Peace, and peace for pieces and peace at Ezekiel 24:4, and one the for and on the. So you have the E versus no E, which changes one to on in Ezekiel 43:20, and for am in Amos and Joel. Particulars, this is from 2 Esdras, hallowed for hallowed at 1 Maccabees 4:48, others for, I don't even know what that word is, oaths? They left the R out. He for ye, Matthew 11:7, against these, 1617 coincides with the first edition errors in giving Jordan, number 32 summary, or no italics for or 2 Samuel. Different spelling of Caiaphas there in Acts 4:6. One with an extra A, right? In Acts 4:6. The balance of error strongly suggests the second edition was the base text, but the presence of these few first edition errors is mysterious. And then I gave you the footnote this time. None of these coincidences can be traced to the inclusion of sheets from the previous editions. A variation at Proverbs. So in other words, they're not just simply reusing sheets here, all right? A variation at Proverbs 18:24 also seems to point to the second edition. Some copies of which turn, quote, "a man that hath friends must show himself friendly," into nonsense by substituting "but" for "most." 2 Samuel 16:17 reads, "will show," which appears to be a sensible correction of this error, but a correction made without reference to the first edition. In several places, distinctive second edition readings or errors occur on the same page or folio as the first edition readings. On the verso for the egregious pieces and piece, Ezekiel 24:4, is the first edition's reference. Jeremiah 49. In 1 Ezra 5, a choice of readings from the two editions together with an error are found on the same page. I'm going to skip all that parentheses. Some combinations of readings must go back to a copy of the second edition and notification in some form of errors of fact and variant readings, but not mere typographical errors. In particular, Jeremiah 49 could not have appeared without the correct reference being supplied by the compositor. Such evidence makes it probable that most or all of the 1617 folio used the second edition as a base text, but that a substantial, though imperfect, effort was made to correct the text with readings that came from the first edition. The result is a text that gives about 2/3 of the first edition readings listed in Appendix 2. Though one should not press the number hard, many of the readings would be natural corrections of second edition errors. This situation is curious. Surely one would argue it would have been easier to have used the first edition as a copy text. Fewer changes would have been needed. And one would also argue that working from the first edition would have been sounder practice and consistent with the way the earlier editions in smaller formats were created. The evidence clearly shows an awareness of the need to correct the second edition, but Barker's workers may not have shared a sense that it would be sounder to work from the first edition. They may have thought that the second edition represented a corrected text, and not realize that working from it would involve them in more changes than if they had worked from the first edition. It is also possible that they used the second edition. It is also possible that the use of the second edition may represent a scholarly choice. By 1617, they may not have had a copy of the first edition available to work from, so may have corrected the second edition from one of the interim editions. So obviously you can see there that Norton is guarding himself against being dogmatic in some of these things that he's saying. Okay, Mike, did you have a comment?
Going back to the previous page where it says or in italics, the reference there, 2 Samuel 13:8, that doesn't jive, and it's apparently an error in Norton's book.
Did you look into 1611?
Yeah. No, not 16.
What's the verse?
2 Samuel 13:8.
Let's look at it. All right, 2 Samuel 13 what?
8.
So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, and he was laid down, I'm assuming, right?
Yep.
And she took
flour
and kneaded it, right? Yep. And made cakes in his fight and did did bake the cakes, okay? I think it's referring to this. Marginal note, or. In other words, they're saying, so if you look at what he's saying here, where are we at on the page? We're on page 8, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
and we're up to the top. All right. So, or here is not in italics. So he's saying, or, if you look at what it says in the, it says, or, no italics, for or with what? Italics. So what Norton's talking about is the marginal note,
okay.
Not the verse, not the text of the verse. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. But let's just stop there for a minute. To me, that shows how thorough Norton is, that he's even checking these. You know, because remember last Sunday we saw, so remember there are three major ways of identifying. And we could look at this page. There's three major ways for identifying different footnotes, right? You have the two vertical lines, which typically represents an alternative Hebrew or Greek word, right? Then you have the dagger. Where did it go in the verse, though?
It's the end of 30.
Yeah, right here. So you have the dagger, gives the Hebrew, okay? And notice that's in italics. And then you have the star or the asterisk, which would indicate a cross reference. So he's even checking the marginal notes. And so that's what he's talking about there in the one that you point out. So I actually don't think it's an error in his book.
Right.
So, but I'm not saying Norton's infallible by any means. I'm just saying he was extremely careful and thorough for the most part in what he's noting. Okay? Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else with a question there? All right, if not, let's go to the conclusion. Yeah, Bart?
Were the printers aware of the errors at the time, or was this brought up later for the corrections?
Yeah, so that's kind of what we're talking about, right? So, we'll just use this one as an example, right? So, was the printer aware that or was technically supposed to be in italics? Well, apparently he was in 1617 because he made the change. And that's kind of the point, right? What document are they using to make sure that they make all of the correct changes in the correct spots? It seems it's uneven in the way it's adopted, right? And that's what he's saying. He's saying, well, if you judge by what's printed, the 1617 seems to be using the second edition as the base text and sprinkling in some readings from the first edition instead of using the first edition as the base text and amending it according to the second edition. So it's like, it's almost like they did it backwards from what you might have expected them to do.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what he's getting at. All right. Now, there's a net effect of all of this, right? And so let's look at the conclusion. Professor Norton concludes chapter 4 by offering some summative statements about the state of the text in 1617. All right? The King's printer is in various combinations of Barker, Norton, and Bill. So let's stop there. You remember that did he farm some of the work out to other print shops and take on, did he have to take on, because of financial trouble, did he have to take on other printers? So this is not all just happening in one print shop. There could be happening in multiple print shops, which is a whole other factor, right? Okay? So the King's printer, in various combinations of Barker, Norton, and Bill, printed many more editions. But there is no more work of textual significance to note. Okay? By 1617, their text had reached some sort of stasis, if not uniformity. So let's stop there. So he's suggesting that by 1617 had things worked themselves into a reasonably standard format for the different printings. Okay? Doesn't mean it's great yet or there's not more work to be done, but had things somewhat stabilized by 1617. Okay? Just as sheets of different editions were mixed, so too were readings. It is a tale of commercial enterprise that was not always competent, tempered with some limited scholarly attention to the text. The incompetence reached its apotheosis by the notorious Wicked Bible, which I talked to you about last week, right? A 1613 octavo that omits not from the seventh commandment. So it literally says, thou shalt commit adultery. Okay? The error may possibly have been sabotage. In other words, somebody did it on purpose. If so, it is eloquent of the personal tensions and shortcomings that contributed to many mysteries in the early texts of the King James Bible. So, remember the one we saw last week? Something like the printers have persecuted me versus, what was it supposed to say now? Prophets, possibly? I can't remember what it was. But it was obviously a mistake. And you could possibly make an argument that somebody did it on purpose. Right? And there's some speculation that the Wicked Bible, with the omission of not from the seventh commandment, is an example of that, where somebody was upset and made their historical mark on the text by intentionally leaving the word not out. Okay? Any comments or questions? Yeah.
I've been following a blog loosely and just the discussion that's going on it, and the pro 1611 camps, ones that state without much backing, they just say, nope, that's the source. That is our source material, and there's nothing ever that's wrong with it. I mean, it's just blind faith, and I get that. But one of the comments basically alluded to, or questions that was alluding to, the removal of the apocryphal books. So I am very ignorant of how that all transpired. So that we don't need to get deep into it. What is the short and sweet of why that was removed, and what authority did it? Because when you look at the 1611, and it's distinctly in there, and so much so that these people, even after the fact, are continuing to make corrections to it, including those books. I guess in this discussion, there's a couple different things that keep popping up, and they're not addressed. They're dancing around it, and I just like to get in my own head and say, okay, this is how this process through.
So I'll just be straight about it. If you look at a Catholic Bible, all the apocryphal books are sprinkled through the Old Testament as though they are part of the Old Testament canon. The first complete Protestant Bible, complete meaning entire Bible, Old and New Testament, was the Coverdale Bible of 1535. Coverdale separated he extracted the apocryphal books out of the Old Testament and put them in their own section between the Testaments, along with an introduction noting the fact of their questionable authority. Now, I have a paper on the church website on this too, AJ. If you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, along the top, click on Why Use KJV, And then you want to look at this one right here from 2012, the Apocrypha in the King James Bible. There's a, it's like 7 or 8 pages, it's not real long, because I've gotten this question a lot over the years, right? So we look at the historical precedent before 1611, and then Coverdale set a precedent. The Great Bible, the Geneva Bible, the Bishop's Bible, they all follow the precedent of extracting the apocryphal books and putting them in their own section. Okay, and then the 1611 does the same thing. So here's the frontage page of the Apocrypha, and then notice in the upper corners of every page, it is explicitly stamped what? Apocrypha. It thereby signifying to the reader that these books are viewed as they are not viewed as canonical. And then what ends up happening is into the 1620s, within 20 years of the KJV's first printing, there start to be printings that are omitting the Apocrypha.
That's what throws me, because those same people that are adhering and saying the 1611 is that's all we follow, but they're not. They don't include those books.
Right.
They're not. They're basically it's hypocritical for one thing, because they're not using the books. Therefore, it's not the 1611. That's what's confusing me, and I'm just trying to unwind that yarn.
Yeah. So there is a segment within King James Onlyism that is 1611, man. You know, and they'll say that there's nothing that I've even heard them say that there's no difference at all, except for spelling, punctuation, and printer errors between a 1611 and a 1769. That's what they'll say. Okay. Look, I've reviewed evidence, and I'm like, yeah, that's an argument of convenience that you can't necessarily prove. There's more going on here than that. I'm convinced of that. Okay, now that puts me at odds with those people, because they're going to say, well, I'm too Norton-esque, or who knows whatever they're going to say, right? But to me, the facts are objective that later, and this really comes in when you start to look at like later editions after the translators are dead, because we're going to talk next about the 1629 and the 1638. Okay, because there's evidence to suggest that at least one or two translators were present when those two editions were compiled by Cambridge University. So in other words, were they there to give direct input into what was being printed? Okay, but yes, those folks that you are referring to are 1611 only, if you will, but they don't really, but that would seemingly logically bind them to the Apocrypha, but they are not apocryphalists.
Right.
I can see where some might, I actually don't really find that part of it to be too inconsistent, just because if I read what the translator's statements about the Apocrypha, like they didn't accept it to be scripture, but there were some liturgical readings in the Anglican Church that still read from the Apocrypha. And remember, this is originally to be a Bible read in church, right? So some of the liturgy, there's liturgy in the what's called the Elizabethan settlement that still had some apocryphal readings in the liturgy. And while these books were not viewed as canonical or scripture, they were still viewed to be interesting historical reading by people at that time. And then things get kind of fuzzy when you start getting into the English Civil War, because the Cromwell and the Puritans take over, and they're definitely not apocryphalists. And then over time, more and more printings just start dropping the inclusion of the Apocrypha. Okay? Yeah. Anybody else? So, just a reminder, no class next Sunday. If you're interested in picking up a copy of the book, those of you that are in-house, there are hard copies here. If you're online and would like one, you go to gracelifepress.com. It is now listed on the website for sale. You can add it to your cart and order it. Still waiting for it to be on Amazon. That hasn't quite processed through yet, but it eventually will be there as well as a Kindle edition. Next Sunday, no class. When we come back, which will then be the first Sunday in May, we're going to look at the 1629 and the 1638, and where does this go from here? Okay? All right, thanks for your time.